Hey everyone, it's Marnie. Just wanted to give you a quick heads up that Helping Couples Heal is now opening our enrollment period for our online couples community. If you're not familiar with the community, it is a pretty incredible one-of-a-kind program that offers couples an opportunity to connect with other couples who are on the path of healing their relationships. And it's just really an extraordinary program. This is for couples who are out of the crisis stage and who have completed a formal therapeutic disclosure. If you are interested or want to learn more, you can go to helpingcouplesheal.com or send an email to support@helpingcouplesheal.com. All right, we're going to go ahead and get started with the episode. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Helping Couples Heal podcast. A place for healing and hope for couples impacted by betrayal resulting from infidelity and or sex addiction. Your hosts are Marnie Breaker and Dwayne Osterland, licensed marriage and family therapists, certified sex addiction therapists, and founders of respective treatment centers in Long Beach, Los Angeles, and San Diego, California. Marnie and Dwayne co-created Helping Couples Heal, a comprehensive program for couples recovering from betrayal trauma, including an in-person two-day workshop, an online aftercare program, and this podcast series is the first component of the program. Thank you for listening. Marnie and Dwayne are committed to helping you recover from the devastating impact of betrayal trauma and are honored to support you wherever you may be in your healing. If you've lost hope, you've come to the right place. Now, take a slow, deep breath, and let's begin with the Helping Couples Heal podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Helping Couples Heal podcast. This is Marnie, and today we're going to be talking with a person who I think is going to be able to bring a lot of insight to all of our listeners. This is somebody who's been working with HCH for a few years now and is one of our coaches, and he lives in the United Kingdom, where he is a counselor, and he is APSEX trained, and he is also a specialist in deceptive sexuality and trauma. It is really my pleasure to introduce Chris Jones, who has truly become an integral part of our work at Helping Couples Heal. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the podcast. It is wonderful to be here with you.
Well, I'm really excited for us to talk. You know, something I've shared with you, Chris, over the years is that our listeners and a lot of our clients, as you know, are often really longing for stories of quote unquote success and looking for hope. And in this process of trying to recover and heal from betrayal trauma, and particularly trying to heal relationships after betrayal, oftentimes it's hard for people to come by those stories of hope or those success stories. So I know from our conversations that you have your own story of recovery and healing. And I thought it would be really helpful to have you come on and share some of that path, that story. What happened for you in terms of how you got through that? Right. What are the things that you learned and what are the things that you employed in your recovery that brought you to where you are now? And perhaps we can start with where you were at the beginning of that story and where you are now. And then we'll move into sort of what happened in between to get you from point A to point B.
Sure. I agree with what you were saying that sometimes doing this kind of work, there's a reluctance as a therapist or maybe as a coach, there can be a reluctance to share our own story because of self-disclosure and so on. And yet, I think it can be a source of great encouragement and great hope to people. So it's something I am relatively open about in my work. In terms of where I was to where I am now, I guess that's a big question. My story started with me actually self-disclosing some of my issues to my wife. And so that was one of the best decisions I ever made. Very difficult, but one of the best decisions I made. But even in saying that, I want to be clear that I very much minimized what was going on. I said enough to kind of tell myself I was being open. So it did start with a self-disclosure, but a lot of the common behaviors that we're going to see around minimization, the trickle disclosures or trickle truths kind of idea, I was very much guilty of those things. But I went into recovery. I was lucky to find some good resources very early on that were partner sensitive.
Can I jump in just for 1 second before we move forward? Because I have a question about something you said.
Yeah.
You self-disclose, which is very uncommon. unfortunately, because as we know, telling the truth and telling it as fast as possible is the best way to ensure an easier healing process.
Yeah.
But what led to you self-disclosing? Why did you make that very difficult decision?
So I think for me, I had wrestled with, you know, it was primarily pornography. I'm a Christian personally, and, you know, a churchgoer. And I was very aware for a long period of time that I was living that kind of double life in a sense, or I was compartmentalized. And it's one of the reasons we'll probably come on to talking at some point about Dr. Minwala's work and the idea of the secret sexual basement. And I very, very much resonate with that from a personal point of view. I was this divided person that had these compartments, but not only these different compartments, but I was living by different values in each compartment. They were directly in opposition. So for me, there was a sense of, I guess, exhaustion of living in that divided way. And so, as I said, that drove me eventually. I think I told myself as well, as so many guys do in this situation, that I'll be able to be honest about it once I've got it under control. And then, of course, the shame, the hiding and all of that perpetuates the cycle when you never get it under control. Mm-hmm. So I think I just got to that point of, I'm not a huge fan of the concept of rock bottom, but it sort of fits. I got to that point of not being able to live with that anymore. And so I did disclose my struggles. But as I said, I don't want to pat myself on the back too much. I found some good support, some very good partner-sensitive support, which I was very lucky to have right from the start. And then after a while, felt really called actually to do something more with this and maybe use my experience and use my story. And so looked into training as a coach. And then I thought, well, I kind of go all in and do therapy training as well. Loved the idea of just a real life change.
What were you doing prior to that idea about transitioning?
So I actually worked in a completely different industry. I worked in finance before that. I ran a business and worked in finance and investment. I'd kind of, I guess, to a degree, achieved my goals in that. And I always had in the back of my mind the idea of doing something vocational in the future, doing something a bit different. And then this recovery journey came along and just suddenly all kind of slotted into place. And a coach I worked with was a guy some people will know called Richard, who used to work for Helping Couples Heal. And so I got to know him. He was a tremendous support to me. He put me in touch with you, and the rest is kind of history.
Mm-hmm. I'll always be grateful to Richard for that.
Yeah, it was one of those things where it just kind of falls into place and it's worked out incredibly perfectly. And then alongside that, as I said, I completed my therapeutic training. So I work as a therapist or counselor in the UK. And yeah, I guess that answers your question. That kind of brings us to the present.
Yeah. And the next question I wanted to ask you, which is something I know you and I share sort of an equal passion about, is how does the model that we work from and the approach we work from and really the model that you used in your own healing differ from the traditional addiction model?
I think that's a hugely important question. So I personally primarily work from the ST model. A lot of people know that as the Minwala model. And even before I knew about the Minwala model, as you say, through my own recovery, it was still very much partner sensitive. I worked with APSATS trained coaches and in groups facilitated by APSATS trained people. So the approach was very much identifying the sexual problem, but identifying the secondary problem that goes with it that often is unfortunately unnoticed, untreated, sometimes completely not acknowledged. I very, very much identified with the kind of compulsive or addictive element to my behavior. If I look at it, it ticked a lot of the boxes. But I think it's also not sufficient to just identify that and get that under control. I'm sure many, many people listening to this will have achieved sobriety or freedom from their identified problematic sexual behaviors, but found that they're still just completely stuck in their relational recovery. And the partner is still very stuck in trauma, feeling unsafe because all of those other behaviors, what I would call integrity abuse from the DST model, are still very much present. So it was incredibly challenging for me because in a sense, it might have been easier to just see it as an addiction problem. It's just a disease I had that I needed treatment for.
And once I get sober from that addiction problem, then we move on and it's over, right? It's without looking at the integrity piece and the abuse piece, it would be a whole lot easier.
It would be a lot easier and also a lot less challenging to the self and my perception of myself. You know, I was a good guy, good husband, good father, and had a porn problem that was an addiction. That in some ways is a lot easier to sit with than there's actually an integrity issue. And there's other relational things going on there that need to be looked at.
Yeah, I see with a lot of my clients that when they first come in for treatment, unlike your story, typically they have been discovered. It's not something that they self-disclosed. Oftentimes the amount of shame that they are sitting with is immeasurable and they can hardly tolerate the shame that they feel. And then when we introduce the integrity abuse piece, that puts on top of all of this enormous shame. So it's like taking a bucket of shame and pouring it on top of a bucket of shame. And if a person doesn't have the right support around that, then likely they're not going to be able to do that work. So I see this pattern oftentimes where somebody comes in for treatment to get sober from the addiction and they're in a relationship and the partner is severely traumatized and really desperate for the one who hurt them to understand it, to validate it, to really get the depth of the pain that was caused by the acting out. And that's where if that person is able to identify and name the integrity abuse that accompanied the acting out, I think the partner would feel more of a sense of safety, more feelings of he or she gets it. But because of the shame, you know, those buckets of shame, particularly in the early stages, I think it makes it really, really difficult. And some people would probably say it feels impossible at the time. It's not impossible, but it might feel that way to unearth all the integrity abuse.
And I think anyone who is engaging with this kind of way of understanding the two-part problem of the sexual issue and the integrity issue is going to run into that at some point. And that the amount of clients I speak to when, you know, new clients or, you know, we're going through these concepts, or they've maybe heard a podcast with Dr. Minwala, for example, or whatever it might be, they will say to me something along the lines of, I listened to it. It all made sense. I follow the logic, but it was not comfortable. And there's that tension of, it seems to be right, but it can't be right because I'm not that person. That can't be right.
It can't be me. Yeah. Way back when I was an intern, we're going back, you know, I don't know, 14 years or something like that. I was working at a sex addiction clinic in Los Angeles, and Dr. Minwala was actually my supervisor at the time. And I remember leading these intensive outpatient programs. I would do lectures and different kinds of supports. And I worked with a lot of male addicts. And I remember very often hearing them say to me, you know, in sort of a state of disbelief and complete not understanding, I don't understand how I did these things. I don't know who I am. That's not the person I thought I was. That's not who I think I am. And how is this possible? And really just, you know, I think one of the things that makes relational healing so difficult after betrayal is that the person who's done the betrayal needs so much to help the partner heal and understand the abuse and understand how the secret deception, that secret deceptive life hurt the partner and the family. But that person who is now coming in and getting sober from the addiction, they're now getting hit with the reality that now the partner's looking at. The partner's like, who are you? What have you done? Where's the person I thought that I married? And then when the person who's done all of this starts to recognize and unearth all of the reality of what they've done and what their behavior has done, I think for them, they experience this, you know, existential identity crisis.
Yeah.
Did that happen for you, Chris?
Yeah, I think for me, it was when you're living it, when you're living with, you know, I'm going to use the metaphor we use of the secret sexual basement, there's a sort of, I often refer to it as almost a self-justification, or it's almost like you've gaslit yourself. You've normalized abnormal behavior to yourself. So it's almost become normal to lie by omission or to minimize things or to hide things or whatever it might be. And as you're saying, it's not until it's all laid in front of you and you see it for what it is. I love that definition. I forget the exact wording, but that definition of mental health being a commitment to reality at all costs. That really resonates with me in this work, in that it's not comfortable, it's not easy, and it's certainly not quick. But if we are just sitting with the addiction piece, and our partner is sat over here with, I mean, they're sitting with the integrity abuse because they've been subjected to it, then we're still in two different realities. I'm still not in reality. I might not be acting out anymore, but I'm still not fully in reality, which is where true mental health and true freedom and all of those things can be found. And so sitting with that discomfort, honestly looking at the destruction that's been caused by my behaviors, looking at them as they really are, becomes actually, ironically, the source of the true health, the true freedom that we're looking for. So yeah, I think it's both incredibly uncomfortable, horrible to go through, and as I said, will take longer than we want it to. That's one of the big things we need to learn with this. But it is where we end up ultimately living in reality. And more importantly, for the relational healing piece, we're both living in the same reality now. We're both looking at the same things, using the same language, and perceiving things the same. So I just think that's absolutely crucial.
And I say consistently and often that if you don't have that shared reality and you don't agree on what has happened, then it's going to be impossible. And I really do use that word impossible. I don't like to generally. I'm a pretty optimistic, positive person. So I like to be like, anything's possible. I don't really think it's possible to have a shared vision of the future when a couple cannot agree on what's happened in the past. So that piece has to happen first. I don't think that there's a lot of hope for a future together, or certainly a beautiful future, you know, the kind of future that a couple would want, if they're not able to share a reality. So Chris, we have to wrap up in a few minutes, and I really think there's a lot more we haven't covered. So I am going to want to come back for a part two, if you're on board for that.
Absolutely.
Okay. But here's a final question that I think is really important and will help a lot of people. What would you tell any of our listeners who are saying, is there any way I can speed up this process? Or who are saying, I don't want to wait that long. I can't wait that long. Or even to a betrayed partner who's saying that same thing. Betrayed partner saying, I can't wait that long. I want my life back. I don't want to be dealing with this any longer. What would you say?
So I think in many ways, that's the million-dollar question. We all want the pill we can take that's going to solve these problems. When I reflect on my own recovery, which I consider an ongoing thing, so I'm not necessarily talking past tense about that, but I think the greatest thing I did, despite many mistakes that I made, many stumbles along the way, the greatest thing for me was there was an extremely high level of internal motivation to change. One of the things I often say pretty much every client is, where are you in terms of internal or external motivation? At the start, especially if we've been discovered, there is a high amount of external motivation. You know, perhaps our relationship is at risk and we're living with lots of dysregulation within the relationship and everything going on. And so there's a lot of external motivation to change. That is hugely powerful and hugely important, and we should want to change for our partners. However, that is not sufficient, because what I see over and over again is the guys I work with who are doing recovery for external reasons like that, at some point, resentment or recovery fatigue or frustration, whatever it is going to set in and is going to undermine the work. And so I think one of the greatest predictors of genuine recovery and speed of recovery is going to be, what is my level of internal motivation, and how, one of our favorite phrases, how all in am I on this recovery work for my partner and my family, but actually for me as well, because this is who I want to be. And so I think, aided by the fact that my recovery journey started with self-disclosure, one thing my wife never, ever had to question was that recovery is what I wanted to do. She never had to question my intention or my motivation to change. That doesn't mean, again, that there weren't stumbles and really difficult periods, but the trajectory of my recovery was always a positive one, in her eyes because she could see what I was doing. She didn't have to tell me, what about this podcast? What about this book? What about this group? She didn't have to chase me up to learn what I was doing in my recovery, how I was growing. It was very, very self-led.
What a gift to your wife. And I want to say that I'm certain that there'll be a lot of partners that are listening to you talk right now that are feeling pain in their hearts and sadness, because that's so desperately what they want their partner to experience, that internal motivation that you're talking about, where the partner didn't have to push this podcast. Or, yeah, I can't tell you how often I talk to people and they say, I've sent this episode of your podcast to my husband. I've told my husband to read this book. I sent that episode of your podcast to my husband. And that's just, I'm not going to say that's not helpful, because I've talked to many men who have listened to the podcast as a result of it being sent to them by their partner. And it's been very helpful and valuable. And it does get them on a path of healing. And that's great. But generally speaking, that's not going to last long term. If your partner has to consistently send you the podcast, consistently send you the articles, consistently suggest different groups for you to join, and at some point that doesn't become something that you are seeking for yourself, I just don't think it's going to work.
Yeah. And even more, what you then so often hear, ironically, is guys feeling micromanaged and feeling like my partner's trying to manage my recovery. And I guess I would put out that challenge of, if you were managing it correctly and showing that desire, showing that intention, would it need to be micromanaged by the other person? So another question I always try and put to my clients is, one, is this actually what you want? So again, that's the internal motivation question. And two, do you believe you can do it? That's another thing that can hold us back, if we honestly think we can never be free from our previous behaviors. And three, do I actually believe it will be worth it? So do I have a vision for a life in recovery that is better than the compartmentalized life that I'm living right now with all of these internal tensions? So I can categorically say, from my perspective, doing recovery is the greatest thing I've ever done, the hardest thing I've ever done, and the greatest thing I've ever done, the greatest decision I've made in my life for my wife and my family, but for me personally as well. So I think those are just some important questions for people to reflect on.
And Chris, you sharing this story with us, I think, is not only a gift to you, to your wife, to your family, but it's really a gift now to thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are going to be listening to this and hearing your story. So I am really hopeful that people will come away from this feeling like there's a lot of hope, because there is. But like you said, you've got to be all in.
Yeah.
So, you know, to those of you who are not all in, figure out what's going on. And if you really want to heal your relationship, and if you really want to heal for you, be all in. Really, those three words to me is where it all begins. I mean, not to say you can't start, maybe not quite there, but if you don't get there, you're not going to end up where you want to end. In any event, I really do want to have you come back and to keep talking. I truly believe that hearing what's worked is oftentimes exactly what's needed for people who feel stuck or who really do want to change and really do want to grow, but honestly don't know how. You know, perhaps they don't have the support that they need, or perhaps they are living with so much shame, they're in so much isolation, they can't talk to others. One of the questions that you are leaving our listeners with, which was, do you believe it's possible? I think for a lot of people, when they're in isolation and they only have their own distorted thoughts and limiting beliefs to reflect on, they might come back with, no, I don't believe it's possible. So I also encourage our listeners who are in that place of more isolation and shame to give yourself the opportunity to seek help from safe people. Maybe it's one safe person. And hopefully you will find out that you can do it. There are people that are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Those people likely will not be able to heal. I believe that those people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves are not the most common. I think that's the exception. So I believe in you. I believe in all of you who are listening today.
Yeah. And I have seen certainly in my own life, in many of my clients and people I've worked with in groups I've run, I have seen incredible change happen. I have seen the people that don't or won't change, or who aren't all in, or who don't really believe in it, all those things we've talked about. But I have seen incredible stories of change. I wouldn't do this work if I didn't think it actually helped people. So yeah, it's beautiful when it happens.
That's what I say all the time. In almost every consult I do with clients that are looking for help and trying to figure out what would be the best treatment plan for them, you know, typically when they come in, there's not a lot of hope. And I always say, I wouldn't do the work that I do if I didn't see healing happen. Yeah. And not just once in a while. I see healing happen quite often. But like you said, remember, you've got to be all in. Right? It doesn't mean that you're not afraid. It doesn't mean that you don't have shame. It doesn't even mean that you feel hopeful, but it's that you do it anyway. There's a great book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway by Sue Jeffers. I love that book. It's pretty dated, but in my opinion, that premise holds true, right? You can feel afraid. You can feel whatever you need to feel, but don't let it stop you. Right? Because if you stop, you have no idea what's on the other side of all of this.
Beautifully said.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for being here. And I look forward to having you come back. If people want to find you, where can they do that?
So I have my own therapy practice here in the UK, which is at chrisjonestherapy.co.uk, where I can obviously work with people based in the UK. For people in other areas all around the world, I work at a wonderful organization called Helping Couples Heal, so I can be found there.
Thank you. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to talking with you again soon. Until then, take care and be gentle with yourselves.
Thank you for listening to the Helping Couples Heal podcast, where your healing is the number one priority. If you'd like additional resources about betrayal trauma or to learn more about the workshop, please visit helpingcouplesheal.com. If you're finding the podcast helpful, please support Marnie and Dwayne in continuing to reach others impacted by betrayal trauma by leaving a review on iTunes and sharing this podcast with someone you care about. Once again, thank you for listening. We're grateful for your trust and look forward to continuing to support you on your journey of healing.